Today in Studio 360, a folk singer becomes a scientist, but he still hears music everywhere.
One evening, I was sitting there listening to these sounds, and it occurred to me that these sounds were kind of symphonic. All of the insect voices and the mammal voices.
Bioacoustician Bernie Krause is stalked by a roaring carnivore, and he's got the tape to prove it. And the whistling, fiddling musician Andrew Bird remembers his own foray into the wild.
Let's see what happens when I stop listening to records. I move out into the middle of nowhere and have this space to experiment.
This land is your land.
Plus, the alternative national anthem, This Land is Your Land by Woody Guthrie. Our look at an American icon. That's all ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
I'm looking at you right now and I'm saying, Kurt, this land is your land. I'm talking to you.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson and this is Nora Guthrie, daughter of the man who wrote what's probably the best-known modern American folk song.
When Woody wrote this, who was he looking at? Who was the you he was talking to?
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island.
And I see all those faces of the people that he writes about, the poor, the white, the black, the Indian, everything that makes up this country. And he looks at each one of them. He says, this land is your land.
This land is your land has become a kind of unofficial national anthem. And today in Studio 360, we'll trace its history all the way back to Okemah, Oklahoma, where Woody Guthrie was born. But let's start a little more recently. On a cold January day in 2009, after 2 years of campaigning all over the country,
are you prepared to take the oath, Senator?
I am.
Barack Obama took the oath of office and became the first non-white president of the United States.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
At his inaugural celebration, Bruce Springsteen and Pete Seeger sang, This Land Is Your Land.
As I went walking
this same song was once called communist and anti-American.
All I could do was look up and say, Dad, there's a song for every moment in time. This big one is your song. This song has been waiting around for that moment. That's what I really felt.
This land is your land.
So how did it start? When I mention Woody Guthrie, what do you picture? Maybe a dust storm. The sound of a freight train. A hobo in one of the boxcars playing his harmonica.
I've been working at Pittsburgh Steel, I thought you knowed. I've been dumping that red hot slag way down the road.
But actually, that was all an image Guthrie had created. The reality was a little different.
The Woody Guthrie you hear on records is not the real Woody Guthrie. That's coon hunting language.
That's Ed Cray, author of the biography Ramblin' Man, The Life and Times of Woody Guthrie.
He puts on an exaggerated drawl. At home, he wrote and spoke in excellent English and with the faintest of drawls.
Woody Guthrie was from a middle-class family that had fallen on hard times.
His father was a real estate operator. Woody once said that he lost, in the post-World War I crash, his father lost a farm every day for 50 days. So that from prosperity, they sank into real desperation or poverty.
But his middle-class background wasn't the only contradiction he embodied.
He sings in a variety of songs about how important it is to have a job if you're a family man. And he was a terrible family man.
Ed Shannon is a professor of literature who's written about Guthrie.
In his autobiography, in fact, he completely ignores the fact that he's married. He's got a wife and three kids at the time he writes the book, and they never even get a mention.
Shannon even argues that Guthrie played a character.
This working class kid who doesn't have any book learning and is sort of thinking off the cuff and saying whatever pops into his mind and fighting the power and standing up for the little guy. That's a really appealing character. And I think if it's not uniquely American, it's certainly something that Americans admire, that urge to say, I did this all by myself. And look, you could do that too.
In 1941, leaving his family behind in Texas, Guthrie came to New York City. Pete Seeger still remembers what Woody Guthrie was like back then.
Okay, and go to the right.
Okay.
Where our fireplace is.
All righty.
I went to visit him in his old wooden cabin on a hill overlooking the Hudson River, a house that he built himself. He's 91 years old now.
You know what I need to do is put on my hearing aid.
Okay. Pete Seeger met Guthrie at a midnight benefit concert for California farm workers.
Woody was the hit of the evening. With his cowboy hat shoved in the back of his head, he would tell stories and then sing a song. You know, it's a very dry state in Oklahoma. I once saw three telephone poles chasing one little dog. Then he'd sing, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, boys, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. He was always cracking jokes, and yet he was basically very serious.
22-year-old Pete and 29-year-old Woody became close friends.
He once said, though, that man Seeger's the youngest man I ever knew. He don't drink, don't smoke, don't chase girls. He's weird.
Well, and here you are 70 years later. But he was a young man then as well.
He was 7 years older than I was. Yeah.
Guthrie had just written This Land Is Your Land on his way to New York, hitchhiking, hobo style.
And with his thumb stuck out into the February wind, he was going across Pennsylvania. And when he went in to get a cup of coffee, he heard Kate Smith singing God Bless America on the jukebox.
Which had just come out in 38.
That's right. It was a hit song. He made up some verses. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. God blessed America for me.
God blessed America for me? Nora Guthrie keeps the original draft of the song in the Guthrie archives.
With the chorus here that he's also crossed out again and again, instead of This Land Is Made For You and Me, it was God Blessed America For Me.
At first, he wrote it almost as a parody of the Irving right. Berlin song. That was kind of country humor at the time, right. So it was like, you know, like tongue-in-cheek, well, God blessed America for me, right. Ha, ha, right. Ha, you know. And then later on, he said, no, it's kind of more serious than that, and this is my own take on the right. country. You know, it's basically, you can look at This Land Is Your Land in a lot of different layers. In one simple way, it's really like a biography. Like when he writes, I roamed and rambled and I followed my footsteps, he had just been roaming and rambling and following his footsteps. Well, where was he rambling? Through the diamond deserts and across the wheat fields waving. So if strictly as an autobiography, it's really, really interesting to just pause and say, oh, this isn't poetry. This is journalism.
It's stylized journalism, yeah.
At the bottom, he wrote, with an asterisk, he'd write, all you can write is what you see. And that becomes kind of the mission statement for him, you know, and for all the people that kind of followed in his footsteps. That's what he would tell all the young songwriters. All you can write is what you see. So
he has, in this more or less original copy, he has the line about the relief office and the line about, the sign says private property. Those didn't end up really making the song. Why do you think that they got edited out?
I don't think they intentionally got edited out for any overt reason. I think that they published a kind of a half of a version with the three verses in a children's songbook, a music teacher's songbook. And the publisher was the one that really liked this song. His name was Howie Richman. And he was the one that took on Woody's work when other publishers wouldn't in the 1950s because the blacklist was already on. We were in the beginning of the McCarthy period. But I think at the time, the thing that the publisher did kind of smartly is, you know, sometimes it's really important to move into the center of culture. We can't always isolate ourselves in the outskirts. And so this was an example of that. I think it was kind of done innocently. And the song never would have been sung by kids if it had all six verses. I mean, who the hell sings all six verses anywhere of any song in any school?
And that is how the song became so immensely popular. It never had a commercial success, never really played on the radio, but kids were singing it all over the country. I remember singing it in grade school in the early 1960s. And Pete Seeger, who'd been blacklisted as a member of the Left Wing Weavers, went on the road with his banjo singing Guthrie's songs. Ed Cray.
When Pete Seeger had to make a living after being blacklisted, he began concertizing wherever he could find an audience. Daycare centers, sympathetic churches, whatever.
This land is your land, this land is my land, from California.
Pete, at every concert on the road like that, Pete would always sing a couple of Woody's songs, sometimes the children's songs, sometimes This Land.
If it's a good song, other people will pick it up and sing it. I don't know where I got that idea. I guess I got it from Woody.
One of the other people who got the idea was Bob Dylan, who, just like Guthrie, had put on an accent and come to New York City from the middle of the country to make himself new. Nora Guthrie says that Dylan was the one who made her father famous.
He got famous one day, and the day was when Bob Dylan's record came out and it had Song to Woody on it.
Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song.
Bada bim, bada boom.
About a funny old world that's coming along.
You know, he had been at the house, he had visited us, he had spent time with my dad at the hospitals, etc. Now, people knew the song This Land Is Your Land because they had grown up singing it, but they didn't know anything about the writer of the song. So that's when it all started coming together, was after Dylan sang that song.
Hey, Woody Guthrie, but I know that you know all the things that I'm a-saying and many times more. I'm a-singing you this song, but I can't sing enough, 'cause there's not many men who've done the things that you've done.
How do you say his name? Gumtree? I can never say his name. Woody Gumtree. Mr. Gumtree. I should have said Woody.
One of my favorite versions of This Land was recorded by Sharon Jones in 2005 and used in the movie Up in the Air.
You know, I have to be truthful to you. When I first heard it, I never paid attention to the song because it was like a folk song. You know, This Land Is Your Land. I may as well say, well, that's white people's song, you know.
Jones was born in Augusta, Georgia, when Jim Crow segregation still ruled.
And then, as you get older, you know, you look at the lyrics and the true meaning of what he wrote the song. You know, he's writing about, he's a poor person. He was like, everybody don't have land. And I look at myself, I'm 54 years old, I don't have no land, you know. And I'm like, that's what he was, you know, talking about, talking to the poor people. The main thing is he may have been white and I'm black, but you know, he felt the same thing that I'm feeling, you know. Like, when I'm on stage, I can't concentrate on it. I just feel it, you know. And so as soon as that, da, 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 sometimes I do the thing like putting my hand over my heart, you know, I'm like the flag, you know. And then I'll come back out, you know. This land is your land. Mm-hmm. This land is my land.
This land is your land.
land is my land. And then I'm just feeling the music, and I'm just feeling the people. I'm looking in their faces, and I'm on a feel thing. Then that's that feel. That's that soul. That's that. I don't even think of the lyrics. They just flow out. From the redwood forest. To me, this song is like, I'm not African, but my ancestors are African, and I am American. And then you can come back and say, we didn't walk over here. We didn't get on ships and bring our family. We was brought over here in chains, you know. And half of us didn't make it, you know, and those that did was the strong ones. And those ones that made it are the ones that, where we are from, our ancestors, you know, the generation after generation. We helped build this land, so this is our land. You know, I am American. You can call me Afro-American, Black Afro-American. You know, we've been called some kind of everything. Negro, colored, black. Then people don't call me black. Just call me. As long as you... You know who I am. And I said, this land was made for you and me. As I was
walking, now they tried to stop me. Not just Bob Dylan and Sharon Jones, but so many musicians have carried the Woody Guthrie torch, even outside the United States.
All told, we came up with about 15 different versions.
That's Jorge Arevalo, the curator of the Woody Guthrie Archives. He says that the song has been used for all kinds of purposes around the world, but that they all share one idea.
There's so many interpretations, but they all really come down to reverence for not property, but the idea of shared ownership.
Except for maybe one. The one by the Jerusalem Taverners. The group's singer, Shai Tochner, grew up listening to Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and then formed a band, which became very popular in Israel.
But at a certain point, we tried to get to more Israelis that did not understand English that well. So one of the songs we thought about was This Land Is Your Land.
This Hebrew version is about different stereotypes within the Israeli population.
The first character is the kibbutznik, you know, the guy who lives in a kibbutz. The second one represents the religious sector. And the third verse was like the American immigrant who comes to Israel just to enjoy the life of Tel Aviv. And one of the verses is like of the settlers which go to the West Bank.
And then the chorus of the song.
Zoi Arzenu, Hivishvilenu, Me'avotenu Yashar Lenu. This is our land, it is meant for us, from our ancestors, directly to us. This is the land for us.
But nowhere in the song does it mention all the Arabs who live in Israel.
No, there were no Arabs mentioned in the song. It was an Israeli show, it was for the Israeli, for the Hebrew-speaking audience. There was not the intention when the song was written or performed. There was no political issue into it.
Jorge Arevalo.
You can understand why this idea of land, if you are the, you know, the Jewish nation, you know, a race that was denied community never having their own state. So you can understand why. Definitely an Israeli version, a Hebrew version, you know. But by the same token, a Palestinian version makes perfect sense.
And the song has also been used by people in one country who are political enemies. Mikael Villa is sort of like the Swedish Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen. He wrote a Swedish version of the song in reaction to right-wing anti-immigrant extremism in the 1990s.
I got some Nazi threats, and this culminated in some right-wing guys trying to kill me. They came at night and they placed a bomb outside the house I was living in and tried to blow me up.
So Mikael V thought, aside from trying to stay safe, what can I do about this?
I'm a singer, so I called up some of my friends, and we made a big concert in the capital of Sweden, in Stockholm. And then I translated this song, This Land Is Your Land, into Swedish.
Det här är ditt land. Det här är mitt land.
What Woody Guthrie does is to take some important landmarks in the United States, and I do the same when I translate his song into Swedish. I take some important landmarks from the west part of Sweden to the east part of Sweden, from the south part of Sweden to the north part of Sweden. This land was made for you and me.
Funny thing is, the people who had tried to kill Mikhail Via were impressed.
My brother warned me when I had made this translation and said, be careful so the song doesn't end up in the hands of the wrong people. And it has happened that some of these neo-Nazi parties published the lyrics of the song on their homepage.
Jorge Arevalo again.
America has always been multicultural in essence, but only now is Europe really facing much more external forces. And even though it's not presented to be nationalism, songs can be used for so many different purposes.
Because the original lyrics of This Land never do say who you are or who I am, or for that matter, who made this land for you and me. Woody Guthrie left those open for all of us to imagine. And that's why the song can so easily take on new lyrics and new meanings. Like Minnesotan Keith Sokola's version, sung in the Native American language Ojibwa. And that openness to interpretation, the universality, is why Guthrie's song isn't some dated relic. It's why it still feels meaningful, alive to us now. At Studio360.org, you can see Woody Guthrie's original manuscript of This Land Is Your Land and watch a video of my visit to Pete Seeger's house. That's all at Studio360.org/American Icons. Coming up, I'll talk with the writer Anne Lamott about how trying to be good turned her bad.
When I had been a kid, I was under so much pressure to do well that I had cheated for a whole summer.
That's in just a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. To read Anne Lamott is to know Anne Lamott, or at least to feel like you know her pretty well. She started out as a novelist, and still is, but her big breakthrough came with nonfiction work. In 1994, at age 40, she published the book Bird by Bird, Some Instruction on Writing and Life. A humble title, given how many thousands, millions of people say that Anne Lamott inspired them to transform their lives. Her new book is called Some Assembly Required. It's about her 19-year-old son becoming a father. I spoke with her last year when her novel Imperfect Birds had just been published and asked her about the meaning of that title.
It's an important line in the book from a Rumi poem that each of us must enter the nest made by the other imperfect bird, which I really think means that when all is said and done, all we have to offer one another is a welcome in each other's messy nests and maybe a cup of tea while we're at it.
Now, Rumi, And you have joked in the past about your California new aginess.
Yeah.
You're one of the very few people who are both of it and can make fun of it.
Uh-huh. I know, but I think Rumi, is Rumi not like an East Coast guy?
Not as much.
No.
I think you have to be in Marin County, yeah, really, to quote Rumi.
Ixnay on the Umi Ray.
So this is your third book about Rosie, the character whom you created at the beginning of your novel writing career. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to write about her again and now again?
Well, that's a good question. The second time I wrote about her, I had wanted always to write about my life as a competitive tennis player because I played tennis in tournaments in Northern California. And then I taught tennis as a young adult, and I was actually an adult and still play. But when I had been a kid, I was under so much pressure to do well that I cheated for a whole summer. And it's a very interesting thing
you
to
cheated?
Have done. I cheated in tournaments, which is odd. I mean, because I'm such a like nice person, I'm a black belt codependent, I want to help everyone and fix everyone, but I was cheating these little girls, you know, and taking points that weren't mine. And I'd always wanted to write about what happens to kids that have too much pressure on them and how it pushes them into shadow parts of themselves that maybe scar them. I felt it scarred me. But also the kids in our county, Marin, which is a wealthy enclave, are very addicted. And they're to drugs. And they're dying. And after the second kid that went to Sam's Public High School died of an OxyContin overdose, I was just saying to the kids, what's going on? Little by little, I started thinking, well, Rosie's a genius. She's a great student. She's brilliant in physics. She's taking all AP courses. She has this history of being a great tennis player, highly ranked. She wouldn't get into that. And she was raised by this wonderful mother. And then I found out I was wrong, that it's part of the zeitgeist, a word I have very, very little occasion to use. And so I just started interviewing girls, and I started to picture Rosie tall and buxom and beautiful now after early teenage years of being skinny and dwarfish and in Crooked Little Heart. And that's how it started with. And I wanted to see the effects of an addicted child on a marriage, because the important thing we usually with a mother and a child who's using is the mother so wants to be friends with a kid and have a great friendship that they do what they did when they were children, which was to agree not to see what's going on. So I wanted to see if Elizabeth could pull herself out of that and realize she wasn't there to be a friend.
Well, this thing you have of parents aren't there to be friends, and I couldn't agree with you more, is, I think, a kind of corollary fact of starting with people our age who kind of refuse to grow up. We still try to imagine that here we're wearing blue jeans and sneakers at work. Have dreadlocks,
yeah.
Speaking for one of us. And look, we're still young. And of course, that naturally bleeds over into, and these kids and their music, and they like our music. So we're just like them.
Yeah, I know.
It's a mistake.
Well, it's an illusion, but it's also based on really old patterns of trying to survive in crazy families, I think. I think that you learn really early on how to help the adults feel better about themselves. And the way you do that is you just don't see what a mess they've made of their life, what a total mess their marriage is. And by 5 or 6, in families where there's drinking, kids, hypothetically me, are, you know, you're mixing drinks. I mean, I would bring people drinks. I was like a little marriage counselor. I had a caseload, everything but a little clipboard. I was the one in the family my brothers could talk to. I was my dad's wife. My job was to make sure dad kept coming home. I was my mom's counselor. What I learned to do was to kind of redo it in my head so it came out to be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We asked our listeners if they had any questions for you, and many of them did, and we have one for you.
Okay.
From Anne Lequier, who lives in Washington, D.C., and she would like to know where you draw the line of privacy in your writing. What?
Well, that's a good question.
Won't you tell?
I don't tell the really juicy stuff about my life. I really don't tell anything interesting about Sam's life. I slapped him once when he was 16, and I wrote a piece about it for Salon. It's in Grace eventually. It's called Heat. Because, as again, I write what I'd like to come upon. And if a very cool, basically really great mother had slapped her kid and had told me, it just happens. They look at you a certain way and you're already at the end of your rope and you lose it. It happens. So I wrote about that and I showed it to him. And he handed it back to me and said, you can't run this because you make me look like the crazy one. And I said, I got it. And I worked on it again and I got it just right.
Yeah. Bird by Bird is, I guess, your most popular book, and it's about writing and how you write and implicitly and explicitly how people might try to write themselves. It's been hugely inspirational for lots and lots of would-be writers and writers. In fact, I know a colleague who says you changed his life with that book.
He so owes me.
He does. Do you feel like a guru at this point for the last 15 years?
I've tried to be very clear and say, I really have nothing to share but what it's like for me and what I'm almost positive it's like for most of us. You know, it's, yeah. I think this is pretty universal stuff. But with writing, it's funny. Sometimes I want to capitalize on Bird by Bird or exploit it, you know. But the thing is that what worked then is what works now. I never, you know, this Imperfect Bird is my 12th book, and I'm sure it's exactly the same with you. You don't sit down and go, God, I'm like somebody. I've had all these books published. Keep, you know, hold me back. You don't. You feel like you go, oh, my God, talk about beating a dead horse, and oh, I hate this. Oh, my butt itches. Oh, I wonder if it's cancer. Oh, I wonder if Chris Matthews is on. Oh, and it's so hard to keep your butt on the chair. And Bird by Bird can be probably summed up in about 3 pages. Keep your butt on the chair. You do it at the same time every day. You never wait for inspiration. It's ridiculous. It will never come. It's another way to keep you from writing. No one in your family is going to hope for you to be a writer. No one's going to be glad to hear you're writing and that you've decided to write a memoir. It's not convenient for anybody for you to write, and you have to do it badly. You know what? You're going to everything that anyone has read that they love
started
began
out
as awful.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything I've written that anyone might think was helpful turned out was 4 pages longer and very purple and overwrought.
So you're a Christian
that
you're,
you know of.
you became a Christian at the same time you gave up drinking.
No, I was a Christian. I was a drunk for a year. I don't think I would have converted sober, but I was going to this little church drunk and not stoned, but hungover and just a raging mess. I heard this great line. Somebody just said that at the end of their drinking, they were deteriorating faster than they could lower their standards.
That's funny.
And I thought that's exactly what it was like for me because I kept getting it to be okay that I had a lot of blackouts and I had a lot of mornings where I just lie there and go, oh, God.
You published several, wrote and published several books successfully in that state.
I did, but I don't think they're good books. But I'm glad I wrote them. But at any rate, I started going to this little church because it had this heavy civil rights soundtrack, this kind of gospel-y 60s soundtrack. And it kind of snuck up on me. I had spent my life trying not to be a Christian because my father was the son of Presbyterian missionaries in Tokyo.
But both your parents were atheists.
Yeah. And not only atheists, but just so contemptuous. If you said you believed in God, I was like, okay, look, thank you. You know, I had a best friend who was Christian Science, and I went there because I had something in me. It was an accident of genes. It probably was my grandfather's thing, skipping a generation. But I just always secretly believed. I never told my parents. My father died at 25 and didn't even know that I had this pursuit going on in me. But because I loved him so much, I tried to be anything but.
If this were 25 years ago and you were still drinking and getting stoned every day and all that, would your affect be different or are you the same? Would you come across as the same person you do now?
I think the best thing about getting older is that it's like editing your work, you know. It's like you start throwing stuff out of the airplane because it's just keeping you flying too low and you're tired of it.
But were you charming and funny and talkative?
Yeah, I was always this way. I was a very shy child, but I was also kind of the ham. At 6 and 7, something might happen on the blacktop, and I would be the one that the kids would look to tell them the story of something they had just collectively witnessed with me. But I could tell it in a way because I was a worried little person with migraines, and I paid attention.
Anne Lamott, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
Anne Lamott's new work of nonfiction is Some Assembly Required, a journal of my son's first son. It's out next week. Coming up, the musician Andrew Bird talks about leaving everything behind to go live on the family farm.
I feel like the melodies and the arrangements since I've been out there and reflecting the landscape too just sort of opened up. When I spend too much time at the barn, the creative process slows down.
Now if you think I'm wasting your time again, I'm wasting your time.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
That's when I thought I'd be the cross in your TRMCTV.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The biologist Bernie Krause has an unconventional theory called biophony. He believes that all animals communicate with each other on their own frequencies, and that when you put all those frequencies together, they interact in a way that's not unlike a symphony orchestra playing. What you're hearing is a bit of the 35,000 hours of nature recordings that Krause has made. Some of his fellow scientists think that the theory is a little out there, but others, like the legendary biologist D.O. Wilson, think he is onto something. As part of our continuing series on science and creativity, Jill DeBoff talked to Bernie Krause about the moment that he discovered biophony.
One evening, I was sitting there listening to these sounds, and it occurred to me that these sounds were kind of symphonic, that all of the voices, all of the insect voices and the mammal voices and the frog voices, all of these critters had found channels to vocalize in without their voices being masked by other creatures.
That's the biologist, Bernie Krause. He's describing his theory of biophony. It's literally a combination of biology and symphony. But he wasn't always a scientist. 2 decades before he began studying biology, Bernie Krause was a guitarist and folk singer.
After I graduated college, I joined a group called the Weavers. We introduced a song called Guantanamera.
After the Weavers broke up, Krause moved to California. It was the early 60s and the psychedelic scene was about to break open. Krause began experimenting with a new electronic keyboard, the Moog synthesizer. In 1967, he and a friend set up a tent at the Monterey Pop Festival, and they sold the Moog to big-name bands.
Like the Monkees and the Birds, all animal sounds, the Beatles. We also sold to the Doors and Frank Zappa.
But the Moog wasn't easy to use.
Because most of these groups were so stoned all the time, they couldn't play the synthesizer. They couldn't figure out how to make it work.
Strange days.
The Moog became so popular, Krause ended up getting work outside the music scene. He started designing sound for Hollywood movies, like Rosemary's Baby and Apocalypse Now.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
I did about a third of the music and the helicopter sounds. And also, I got fired 8 times.
But every time director Francis Ford Coppola fired him, he rehired him for twice the pay.
Smells like victory.
At least you know the risks when you're working with animals.
Krause hadn't spent much time with animals up to this point. But then a friend of his suggested he make a concept album about ecology.
I didn't know what ecology was at the time. I thought the wild was the zoo. What did I know?
But he ended up making that album and called it In a Wild Sanctuary. It mixed rock music with sounds he recorded at the San Francisco Zoo and the Pacific Ocean.
Being out there for the first time with earphones on, that was the moment that I decided I wanted to be outdoors instead of in, and I wanted to figure out a way in my life to do that however long I was going to live.
So Krauss got his PhD in biology and became a bioacoustician, someone who records the sounds of nature. He started by going to far-off places like Antarctica, Borneo, and the Amazon.
I heard this growl in my headphones. We had kind of sensed that something was following us down the trail anyway, because we could smell the urine of the animal. We couldn't hear it or see it, though. But boy, when I set up my mics, I sure heard it. I was frozen solid. It was just terrifying.
But Krauss's notion that nature operates on a symphonic spectrum has its critics. Some biologists are skeptical that animals choose to jump onto specific frequencies. And as to whether biophony has practical uses?
Well, for one thing, it's being used as an analgesic in medicine to calm patients down, lower their stress levels, wean them off pain medication.
Bernie Krauss sees his research as activism. When man-made noises interfere with a segment of the spectrum and suddenly animals can't communicate, they die out. His own sound library reflects the disappearing ecosystem.
Over 40% of that collection comes from habitats that are now virtually extinct. 40% of that library comes from sounds you can't hear anymore.
An example of this is Krauss's recording of Lincoln Meadow at Yuba Pass, California. Here it is before the forest was logged. Listen to Krauss's recording 1 year after logging. The density of the ecosystem has been greatly reduced. Krauss says the mating call of a warbler or the warning call of a cricket is like a soloist in a symphony orchestra.
If you think what a musical score looks like, that's the kind of vision that I had in my head as a result of listening to this stuff.
But this stuff won't last forever. And Krauss says there's only one way to appreciate what we've got now.
Quiet down. Be quiet. And the other thing is, just listen.
For Studio 360, I'm Jill Duboff.
Bernie Krauss's new book, The Great Animal Orchestra, is out right now. Every animal sound you heard in that story was recorded by Bernie Krauss.
It's oh so quiet. It's oh so still. You're all alone. And so peaceful until...
It was pretty much love at first listen with Andrew Bird. I absolutely adored his music as soon as I heard it. How much do I like Andrew Bird? A couple of weeks ago, I stood for 2 hours in a packed room, not my favorite experience, to hear him play songs from his new record. The album is called Break It Yourself.
There are places we must go to. The rain is Hollywood's on bathroom. You must cross a muddy river where love tends to you, love tends to you fear. You see you down love, there's only one way.
When his solo career was just getting off the ground some years ago, Bird left the music scene in Chicago to live by himself in a barn on his family's farm in downstate Illinois. Isolated from other musicians and even from the radio, he found his music developing in ways he hadn't expected.
The barn is situated on 350 acres of rolling hills and limestone cliffs and springs and forests. It's really close to the Mississippi River, so it's kind of where the glaciers sort of mist. And there's corn and soybeans and chickens. It's crazy. When I moved out there, I drove out there in a snowstorm in late February, and there was no one out there. And the barn wasn't quite finished, and I was loading in all my stuff, and I went out to the chicken shack, and the sun had just gone down. It was kind of like that purplish sky, and it was snowing, and there was a peacock sitting on the back of my grandpa's 73 Chevy pickup truck. I've never seen a peacock again since I've been there. It was a weird way to start this whole, like, kind of 3-year antisocial adventure. I felt like I needed a place to get away and to work. What it ended up being is, like, this sort of self-imposed vacuum. Like, let's see what happens when I stop listening to records, I move out into the middle of nowhere, and have this space to experiment and let melodic ideas come out of wherever they come out of. I feel like the melodies and the arrangements, since I've been out there and reflecting the landscape too, just sort of opened up. When I spend too much time at the barn, the creative process slows down and I'm writing less songs, but I'm getting deeper in those songs. But I'm aware of, like, that things have kind of been grinding to a slower pace since I've been out there just in my own head. I think what I'm able to create by myself is somehow more interesting than what I could do with the band right now. I both have this, like, isolation to work and experiment, but I also go straight from that experimentation and working with myself straight to a stage now with the solo show. Whereas before I'd have to, you know, schedule rehearsals with my band and kind of go through this negotiation of sort of letting go of your songs. Really who I interact with now instead of a band is the audience. A lot of times I'll play a half-finished song for the audience and, like, as if to ask them what they think, you know. That's replaced my band, really. I think the lyrics have gotten a lot more like internal conversations. Like Lull, for instance, became like the theme about someone who's trying to convince themselves that it's cool to be alone. Being alone can be quite romantic, like Jacques Cousteau, Underneath the Atlantic.
Being alone, it can be quite romantic, like Jacques Cousteau, Underneath the Atlantic, a fantastic.
And then then there's a completely ridiculous line, which is embarrassing and self-conscious, but became so true. I'm rambling on rather self-consciously, stirring these condiments into my tea, and I think I'm so lame, I bet I think this song is about me. Don't I?
I'm so lame, but I think this song is about me. Don't I? I'm in a low.
Ultimately, when I was out there, I had to convince myself that being alone, though sometimes necessary, really, you can convince yourself that it's romantic if that makes you feel better. It was this sort of extreme experiment, and it was really cool, and all this cool stuff came out of it. But, you know, in many cultures, moving out and being isolated and from everyone else is like a fate worse than death, you know? And there I was out there just kind of obsessing over that idea. Like, what? Why am I out here? What drove me to live in a barn by myself in the middle of nowhere? So all the while, I knew that there was going to come a time when I had to come back and re-engage and play with musicians again, and that time has finally come. So
stretched out on a tarmac, miles south of North Platte, he can't stand to look back. 16 tons of hazmat,
Andrew Bird's new album is called Break It Yourself. Jonathan Menjivar produced our story. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogeson,
Alana Harper,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org. Studio 360's American Icons Project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
Somebody there?
Somebody.
Who said that?
The great actor Willem Dafoe, that's who. How many people could play both Jesus Christ and the Green Goblin?
You know how much I sacrificed?
Willem Dafoe talks with me about his roles in three new movies. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.